Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of June. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about Cuba with the co-editor of Love, Loss, and Longing, the impact of U.S. travel policy on Cuban-American families. I don't think too many Americans are aware that Cuban-Americans can only visit immediate family on the island of Cuba and for no more than 2 weeks once every 3 years. They must apply for a specific license to do that. The Treasury Department defines who is and who is not an immediate family member. That means that there's not a chance of visiting a cousin, even if you were raised together, and certainly not aunts or uncles. There are no more humanitarian exceptions for family illness or crisis. So, as the book says, if Maria visited her mother in June, but is then told in September that her mother is gravely ill, there's no way she can get an emergency license to be at her mother's bedside. Rather, she must wait another 3 years and then visit her mother's grave. This hour of the program, Jeff Thiel is joining us. Jeff is program director of the Washington Office on Latin America, consults with staff about all programs, and directly oversees the Cuba and Central America teams, including the Central America Youth Gangs Program. He's followed Central America issues since the mid-80s and Cuba issues since the mid-90s. Previously, he was the founder and executive director of the El Salvador Policy Project in Washington. He has a master's in industrial relations from the University of Wisconsin and grew up right here in Milwaukee. He is going to be in Milwaukee tomorrow at the Schwartz Bookstore in Shorewood on Friday night to talk about this book that he has edited, Love, Loss, and Longing, a collection of photos and interviews with Cuban Americans who are no longer able to visit their relatives in Cuba more than once every 3 years. We'll be talking about that. We'll be looking at U.S. policy toward Cuba. Jeff says it's been stuck in a rut for decades. And look at what's going on in Cuba itself. Our phone number, as always, is 1-800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Jeff Thiel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen. I'm happy to be here.
The stories in this book are so poignant. They're just people who really care about their families, who want to have a chance to see them, to strengthen family ties. In many cases, there's sickness, there may be a burial, and they can't go. Why?
You're right. These stories are really poignant, and we did the photo exhibit in this book because they are such kind of sad human tales. The Clinton administration made it easier for Cuban Americans to visit their relatives on the island, and the Bush administration, over the course of 3 or 4 years, tightened that up, arguing that family visits, people brought money to their relatives, and that money was helping the Cuban government survive, which the Bush administration clearly doesn't want.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the result. I mean, as the book says, as the photo exhibit says, you have these cases where people have to decide, are they going to go back and visit their dying parent, or are they going to go back and attend the funeral? There's actually one very dramatic story. There's a guy who left Cuba in the mid-90s, came here and became a paramedic, joined the National Guard, and volunteered to serve as a combat medic in Iraq.
Yes.
And on leave from Iraq, he tried to go visit his sons back in Havana and was told he couldn't. So here's a guy who's come here who volunteers to join the service, and whatever you think of the war in Iraq, does this pretty selfless kind of gesture. And we deny him the opportunity to visit his children. It's just astonishing.
Mm-hmm. And the ties between the people who are living in America and the relatives who are in Cuba are still quite strong, aren't they?
That's actually one of the really striking things. There's about 1.5 million Cuban Americans in the U.S., probably 1 million of them born on the island. And despite almost 50 years now of embargo, the relations between those people are very close. And when, after the Pope's visit, the number of Cuban Americans going back to Cuba accelerated dramatically, those ties got really deepened and strengthened. And, you know, like immigrants everywhere, Cuban Americans send about close to $1 billion a year back to Cuba. They try and visit relatives and talk to them every chance they can. And what's happened is we've put this artificial barrier in place between these kind of human contacts.
There are, of course, and they're mostly located in Florida, in the Miami area, a number of Cuban Americans who are very anti-Fidel. Are they in favor, though, of these kinds of travel restrictions?
Well, that's the interesting thing. At one time, they were. And starting with the visit of the Pope to Cuba and kind of growing from there, sentiment for family travel has gone way up. And today, the Cuban-American community in Florida is probably leans slightly, probably 60-40, something like that, toward permitting family travel. So that's a real sea change in the political opinion in Miami itself.
Why is it that this policy, Jeff, has, as you say, been stuck in a rut for decades?
Well, the sad thing is it's stuck for domestic political reasons, and it's stuck because of the power of the Cuban-American community in Florida and, to a somewhat lesser extent, New Jersey, and the importance of those two states in presidential elections. You know, there was an argument, I don't happen to agree with it, but there was an argument during the Cold War for the embargo against Cuba. If that argument ever made any sense, it disappeared almost, you know, 15, 16 years ago now with the end of the Soviet Union and the end of the Soviet bloc and the hostility between Cuba and the United States and so on. And there's just no rational foreign policy argument for having a complete and total embargo on Cuba. We certainly have differences with the Cuban government and disagreements and their human rights concerns, but an embargo and the blockade we have just doesn't make any sense. What's kept it in place has been the organized power of the Cuban-American community in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's really clear. In 1992, so 16 years ago now, when Bill Clinton first campaigned for office, he went to Miami. He appeared at a lunch sponsored by a conservative Cuban-American lobbying organization, and he committed to being tougher than George Bush Sr. on Cuba policy. And what I think that reflects is that that was an important political constituency for him, not that he had a foreign policy commitment to keeping the embargo in Cuba.
Right. What kind of openness would you like to see? What would you like to see change?
Well, there's two different things. First of all, just overall, we have the wrong approach. I mean, we have an embargo that has humanitarian impacts in Cuba and impacts on Cuban-American families, an embargo that denies all Americans the right to travel and see the country for themselves. You know, it doesn't make any sense, and we should basically end it. What we ought to do, I think, step by step, and what a new administration ought to do step by step, is end the ban on family travel, expand trade with Cuba. Right now, we sell almost half a billion dollars a year worth of agricultural goods to Cuba. So we ought to expand two-way trade to Cuba. We ought to end the ban on travel in general for all Americans. And we ought to move toward talking with the Cubans about the issues we have in common. So environmental issues in the Florida Straits, cooperation on drug trafficking, immigration. There's a whole set of issues like that. So I think we ought to take those series of steps and move toward more normal relations with the island.
Mm-hmm. When have relations, under what presidents, have relations been much better?
Interestingly, every single American president has had back-channel negotiations with the Cubans.
Hmm.
And Richard Nixon's administration started back-channel negotiations.
Really?
Yeah, astonishingly, in the early 70s. And as a result, under Jimmy Carter, the U.S. and Cuba permitted travel for the first time in 15 years and reopened not embassies but interest sections in each other's countries. So that was kind of the high point. With the Reagan administration and then Bush 1, relations cooled again. In the middle of Bill Clinton's 8 years in office, relations began to warm somewhat, and family travel and then academic and cultural travel expanded. And then with the Bush administration, they've tightened up again.
Mm-hmm. And what about the presidential candidates? You talk about McCain saying that he would maintain restrictions on family visit. Is that subject to change, or is he adamant?
Well, that's an interesting question. McCain and Obama both spoke in Miami the week before last. And McCain promised to maintain the current restrictions, including the restrictions on family travel. And Obama promised to open the family travel restrictions and to consider other steps and diplomatic discussions. I think clearly the Obama administration is likely to make more change and make it faster. I would be surprised if over time the McCain administration, wouldn't at least consider the family issue, because it's such a clear humanitarian issue and because the Cuban-American community is really changing.
Right. You've been to Cuba some 12 times, if not more. How did you get in?
Well, I used to have a license to take groups in the Clinton in 1997. I got a license to take groups to look at Cuban society and Cuban foreign policy issues, and I took half a dozen different groups, including a number of members of Congress. My license came up for renewal in late 2001. And the Bush administration has had my license renewal application under review for the last 7 years now.
Oh, my gosh.
So clearly I'm not going to get, or I haven't gotten a license to take groups to Cuba. But, you know, there are limited categories of people who can travel to Cuba, and one category is full-time professional researchers. And because I write about Cuba frequently and talk to groups about it and talk to congressional offices and so on, I qualify as a full-time researcher, so I can travel legally.
And what's the response in Cuba to all of this? Are there channels where people can express their displeasure?
How should I answer this? In Cuba itself, first thing to say is that Cubans on the island like Americans. They like Cuban Americans and their relatives, and they like Americans in general. And like a lot of Latin America, enormous numbers of Cubans have relatives here already to whom they talk regularly. So I have never received anything but a warm reception either from Cuban officialdom or from people on the streets in Cuba. Most Cubans kind of shake their heads at what's going on here and don't understand why we have such a dogmatic and inflexible policy.
Mm-hmm. And the people we're talking about who are living here have come in waves. The people the book talks about how they arrived in the United States.
Right,
and
it's interesting. People have this image of all Cuban Americans as kind of fire-breathing and Castro types, and it's not actually true. I mean, there's a wave in the early 60s of Cuban Americans who are fearful about what Castro means and worried that they're going to lose their property or worried that they're going to, you know, take their children and send them to concentration camps or something like that. And you see this big wave of mostly kind of middle-class and upper-middle-class Cubans coming to the U.S. Later waves, actually beginning, the most well-known wave is the Mariel Boatlift wave in the early 80s. And interestingly, most people, those people are usually called Marielitos, most Marielitos weren't fleeing for political reasons. Most of them, like most other immigrants to this country, came here for economic reasons. And I think if you look at the subsequent waves of immigration in the 90s, most of those Cubans came for economic reasons. They came for better jobs, for closer ties to relatives here, and so on. And like most immigrants, they may love or hate or have whatever view they have about their own native government, but they came here primarily for economic rather than political reasons. And that's a really big shift in the Cuban-American community. If you look at younger Cuban-Americans and newer immigrants, they're much less hostile to the Cuban government and much less supportive of the U.S. embargo in Cuba, and certainly almost uniformly not supportive of this ban on family travel, because all of them want to be able to go back and see their relatives.
It's hard to understand the basis of all of this. If it's a leftover from the long-ago Bay of Pigs, if it's the proximity of this island and we are afraid they're out to get us, or...
I think there's a couple of different things at work. There is, from the first wave of Cuban Americans here, who just hated the Castro regime and supported and often participated in the Bay of Pigs invasion and hoped to see Castro overthrown, many of those people became the sort of dominant political voice in the Cuban-American community. And during the Cold War, you know, their kind of immediate interests linked to this larger U.S. geopolitical fight. And so you get this kind of common position. Since then, I think the comparison I make is with my grandfather came from Ireland a century ago and never had a good word to say about the British in his life.
Right.
And if he were to set U.S. policy toward Britain, we would have had an embargo on Britain.
Right.
So I, some of it is that, and you know, you see that in lots of other communities. I mean, U.S. policy toward Armenia has been heavily shaped by Armenian communities in the U.S., for example. So that's part of it. And part of it is this kind of Cold War holdover. There are a lot of politicians, well, and a lot of Americans, really, who haven't thought about, I mean, Cuba's a small country. It's not really significant in the world scheme of things. And so to the extent people think about it, they have this view. They often have this view that was shaped by discussions about Cuba in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and Fidel Castro is, you know, our leading opponent in this hemisphere and that kind of stuff. And there's this sort of holdover that makes people reluctant, including politicians, reluctant to move forward and make a change in policy.
Jeff Thiel is our guest this hour, Program Director of the Washington Office on Latin America. He will be speaking tomorrow at Schwartz Bookstore in Shorewood, actually, at 7 o'clock, talking about the book that he has co-edited, Love, Loss, and Longing, The Impact of U.S. Travel Policy on Cuban-American Families. And it tells some very heartbreaking stories about how they are not able to get to their families on the island. They can only visit immediate family, we'll stress that, on the island, and for no more than 2 weeks, once every 3 years, and must apply for a specific license to do that. This book is a collection of photos and narratives, and it flows from an exhibit that's been traveling nationally since May of 2006. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. A couple questions for you. What do you make of this policy? What do you make of the history of this policy? And then we can also talk about what's been going on in Cuba itself, with Castro retiring as chief of state. His brother Raul has begun what Jeff says is modest but real progress as of reform in Cuba right now. So we'll go to your phone calls, to your emails in a moment, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers, 414-227-2050. Email at talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff Thiel is our guest. Jeff is Program Director of the Washington Office on Latin America. Once again, our number is 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And we start our calls, Jeff, with Steve from Fish Creek. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. It's such a pleasure to hear this. I was in Cuba in the 80s as a journalist, and I came back to write feature stories for a New York Times owned paper in Florida that were a bit controversial, because I basically presented a view of Cuba that wasn't seen very often and wasn't spoken about because of the anti-Castro feelings. And I see that our government seems to continually paint a black, dark picture of governments who have systems with which we disagree, like China and Cuba. And there are so many wonderful things happening in both of these countries to which I have visited that don't get talked about. You know, Castro brought the literacy rate up dramatically in Cuba. Cuban doctors are working all over the world, and there are basically free health care in Cuba for everyone. And these things don't ever get talked about, and it really bothers me because it's so much propaganda in our own country. And I just will let that ride with you and listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
I think that's a great comment. Two things I'd say about it. One, because of the ban on, I mean, Steve had the opportunity to go to Cuba and report on it. And because of the ban on travel to Cuba, most Americans can't. And so most people don't have any real idea of what the country is like or not like. And they've got these images that are shaped by these kind of Cold War visions and Cuba as a prison state and all that kind of thing. And while, as I say, there are questions and concerns and differences the U.S. government has with Cuba, and there are real issues about human rights in Cuba, at the same time, it's a wonderful, beautiful country, friendly people. Havana is a fabulous city, lots of music and culture, you know, all kind of an exciting place to visit. And, you know, as Steve points out, Cuba has one of the highest literacy rates in the world, and a literacy rate that is almost as high as that of the United States. Cuba has a has free medical care, and it has its medical system has problems. It has shortages of prescription drugs and that kind of thing, but free doctor care. So you know, there's a number of things going on there that we don't see or think about or talk about very much that are really positive and interesting things about the country.
And what's the downside?
Well, the downside is, first of all, Cuba's a single-party state, right? I mean, there are, while at the local level elections are competitive, there aren't other political parties. Mm-hmm. That's the most fundamental thing. The second thing kind of connected to that is there are restrictions on freedom of speech in Cuba and freedom of association. And I don't mean that to say that Cubans aren't afraid to tell you what they think, because my experience is that they certainly are. And they'll tell you what they think about the government, and they'll tell you what they think about the United States and everything else. If you want to organize a separate political party to express that point of view, you'll have problems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the biggest downside. The other issue I would say is that while inequality in Cuba is less than almost everywhere else in the Western Hemisphere. So the lowest paid people in Cuba and the highest paid people in Cuba are much closer than they are, certainly in the United States, and clearly almost everywhere else in Latin America. The flip side of that is that average salaries in Cuba tend to be extremely low. I mean, Cubans get their health care free, they get their housing set at 10% of whatever their income happens to be. They get food is subsidized for almost everyone. So it's not exactly comparable, but the average Cuban state employee makes about $20 a month.
Mm.
So people are, it's certainly not an affluent. For a country that's not affluent at all, it's a relatively egalitarian country, and it's a country where healthcare is not an issue, education is not an issue, but it's a country that's, it's not a well-off country.
Right.
I mean, the joke Cubans make about this is that they live like poor people and they die like rich people, because Cubans, because of their healthcare system, live almost as long as people in the United States and tend to die of the diseases people die of in well-off first-world countries. So Cubans die of heart disease, overweight, advanced forms of cancer, and the kind of diseases that kill people in first world countries rather than the diseases that kill people in third world countries, malnutrition, poor water, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Frank from Howard. The U.S. government puts itself on the same level as the former Soviet Union in restricting the travel of its citizens. I know of no other democracy that believes that it has the right to do this. Has this policy been tested in the courts?
Well, unfortunately, it has. I mean, the comment is really right. You know, Americans can travel, U.S. citizens can travel to Iran and North Korea and Iraq and Zimbabwe and every other country with whom we're at odds in the world, but they can't travel to Cuba. And that's, you know, unlike travel everywhere else and unlike most other countries. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has ruled a couple of times that the government has the authority to restrict travel. Now, technically, actually, it's legal to travel to Cuba. What's not legal is to spend money. So if you can find a way to travel to Cuba and prove that you haven't spent a penny doing so, you can't be prosecuted for doing that. What you can be prosecuted for is spending money in Cuba. That's sort of the way the legislation, the court decisions have worked out.
Which you have to do, right?
Yeah, of course.
Right.
I mean, you can try to fly in a non-Cuban airline. You can try to stay at people's houses. You can try and have people give you food and services. But, you know, not really. No, that's not. There are people who've tried to sort of make that case, but it's a hard one to make.
Right. Lori from Oconomowoc is next. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Jeff, I have a question. Didn't Cuba change their policies to not accept the U.S. dollar in Cuba a few years ago?
Yes, they did. Let me think, 3 years ago or
four?
Cuba, right, starting in the early 90s when Cuba had a huge economic crisis after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuba legalized the use of dollars. And so they used to, for a long time, they had two currencies, one in dollars and one in Cuban pesos. About 3 years ago, they stopped accepting U.S. dollars, and they still have two currencies, one of which is a Cuban equivalent to the dollar, mm-hmm. and you trade your dollars in for this Cuban equivalent currency. One of the big changes Cuba is likely to make over the next couple of years, and one that most economists think is a really smart move, is they're going to move from having this dual currency system mm-hmm. to a system of a single unified national currency.
Well, you know, I believe in your cause about the visitation and whatnot, but there was a documentary that came out called Life and Debt by Jamaica Kincaid
mm-hmm.
about the systematic economic trade takeover by the U.S. and the Caribbean. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, based on, you know, a lot of the history that's been going on in the Caribbean, it looks like, you know, Cuba was the last holdout, as it were, and then they're kind of punishing for it. And then you know, China's communist, and there's no even a blurb about that.
Yeah.
It's just mind-boggling. And I guess my other comment was, you know, do you know which countries are actually supporting the embargo? The U.S.
Almost none. You know, the U.N. has a vote every fall on the U.N. General Assembly on voting on opposing the U.S. embargo to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And there are only three countries that vote with the United States in the entire General Assembly.
Oh, my gosh.
So every year the vote is like 160-something to three. And it's the United States, it's Israel, which is interesting because Israel actually has a lot of trade and investment with Cuba.
Interesting.
And usually, I think last year it was Micronesia, but it's there's usually a single third country. So it's a policy that's pretty isolated. Every other country, almost every other country in the world has diplomatic relations with Cuba. Almost every other country in the world has trade relations. We're the only one with an embargo like this.
I'd just like to make one more question. There is a group that does go down to Cuba called Pastors for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
They take down a lot of supplies, medical, educational, cars, whatever, you know, and they go through, you know, Canada or Mexico. And that's another way people get to Cuba.
Right. Actually, just on that front, well, first of all, Milwaukee has a sister city relationship with Nuevitas, a small town in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Madison has a sister city relationship with Camagüey, a bigger city in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that the Pastors for Peace group that's going to Cuba this summer
yes.
is actually stopping in Milwaukee in a couple of weeks
mm-hmm.
on their way to Cuba. And I believe there's also a Wisconsin Medical Association, Wisconsin Medical Commission, that regularly raises money to send medical supplies to Cuba. So there's a lot going on, you know, locally and in the state in terms of relations between the U.S. and Cuba.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Art from Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Art.
I'm with the Wisconsin Coalition to Normalize Relations with Cuba and been there and as a lawyer represent people who've traveled to Cuba around the country. So it's great to have Jeff on. I guess what I would chiefly comment on is ask people and challenge people not to be totally passive about this, but there are ways that people can actively participate and challenge this restriction on our freedom. The last caller mentioned Pastors for Peace. Pastors for Peace will be several people from Milwaukee who are going on the This is civil disobedience travel challenge to the embargo where they don't get a license and they go and they hold press conferences and they say there's a moral and religious commitment. We're going to go and be with our brothers and sisters in Cuba. And so that's going to be stopping in Madison on June 20th at the Just Coffee Cafe Co-op in the evening and both in Milwaukee and Waukesha on Saturday evening, June 21, and we're collecting humanitarian donations, Bibles in Spanish, and medicines and things like that between now and June 21. And if anyone would like to get more information about that movement, our website is wicuba.org. It's wicuba.org, or the phone number in Milwaukee, 414-273-1040, 273-1040, or WICuba. And, Jeff, if you have a chance, since human rights is certainly an important issue, if you can comment at all before you're done on the cases like Posada and the Cuban mm-hmm. Five, because I think people here think the political prisoners are only far away and they don't yep. quite know some of these issues here.
Thanks, Art.
Let me make two different comments. One on Art's call for people not to just sort of accept this. I mean, I agree with that completely. I think, we're all U.S. citizens, and it's a policy of our government, and it ought to be changed, and we ought to participate in changing it. One way to do that is, as Art said, to look at groups like Pastors. I'm doing a workshop Saturday at the Peace Center in Milwaukee that will talk about forms of legal travel that currently do exist for people. And then the other question is pushing a next administration and the U.S. government in general to change the policy, which affects all of us. If you look at the Wisconsin congressional delegation, for example, both senators, Feingold more than Cole, but both senators and five of the eight representatives have generally voted in favor of lifting the ban on travel for U.S. citizens. And I hope they will continue to do so, and people will encourage them to do so, and I hope the other three will be persuaded. And I hope people who care about this issue will let them know. And then on the other issue Art raised about political prisoners and Posada and the Cuban Five, some quick background. Cuban exile Posada has been very active in the anti-Castro movement since the early 60s, participated in the Bay of Pigs invasion and so on, was a CIA asset in the 1970s, and at some point involved in blowing up an airliner that was flying from Venezuela to Havana, killed the Cuban youth fencing team, killed a whole set of people. He was briefly in jail in Venezuela. He escaped from prison there and has been hiding out for more than 15 years. He gave an interview with the Washington Post about five or six years ago in which he said that he had been involved in planting bombs at tourist hotels in Havana in the 1990s, including one that killed an Italian tourist. He snuck across the border into Florida almost 3 years ago now, was arrested on an illegal immigration charge. Currently, the charges have been dismissed against him, and there's just a dinner in his honor in the Cuban-American community, in the exile hardline sector in the Cuban-American community in Miami. So you've got a case of somebody who's, said publicly to newspaper reporters that he's involved in bombings, he's been in prison for involvement, escaped from prison for involvement in an airline bombing, and he's living currently, the charges against him have been dropped. So that raises real questions about sort of what's our standard about terrorism. And then on the flip side, in the 2000 or 2001, I'm not going to remember the exact year, number of Cubans living in South Florida were arrested and charged with espionage. They had primarily been involved in infiltrating kind of hardline exile groups and reporting back to the Cuban government about it. They were all charged with kind of the most severe penalties possible. They're all convicted in Miami, where the atmosphere generally, usually not described as a neutral one for a jury, and they're given up to life imprisonment kind of sentences. One of them is actually serving a sentence in Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. So you've got people imprisoned on these really serious charges, these espionage charges, when they're primarily looking at the hardline Cuban-American community and what they're doing against Cuba. And then you've got Posada on the other side living free in Miami. So it raises real questions about whether we've got a single standard about terrorism here.
Thanks very much for your call, Art. Our number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. With Fidel Castro retiring as chief of state, you've written to me that his brother Raul has begun modest but real progress of reform, Jeff. What kind of reform?
that people have just talked about in the last few months are Cubans who couldn't do this before can now buy cell phones, personal computers, a couple kind of easy but high visibility things like that. But what's most interesting is the Cubans have clearly begun a process of economic reform. As I mentioned, I think they're moving toward a single currency. They're moving toward changing the Cuban agricultural system to increase productivity and decentralize. And they're probably going to move away from the current kind of universal subsidy for food and move toward a more mixed sort of system. So I think you're seeing economic reform, and I think you're the beginnings of a process of economic reform, and I don't, that process isn't going to end, I don't think, with Cuba becoming sort of a free market country. But I think Cuba is becoming, the Cuban economy is beginning a process of internal change toward a more mixed economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think around the edges, you see some greater political opening in internal debate inside Cuba itself. And I think that, for me, the most interesting question is how that goes on and where all of that goes.
More phone calls for Jeff in a moment. Jeff Thale is our guest, program director of the Washington Office on Latin America, and he is going to be in Milwaukee tomorrow for a book signing. He's co-editor of Love, Loss, and Longing, The Impact of U.S. Travel Policy on Cuban-American Families. Did I give you the phone number from Milwaukee? 414-227-2050, or the email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be looking at the evolution of language with a linguist, journalist, and author of The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. Jeff Thale is with us now. 800-486-8655 is our number. Another email coming in because the Miami Cubans, Jeff, are leftover supporters from the capitalist dictator Batista. Their story is twisted capitalism, and they want a takeover of Cuba and to control it again. The U.S. has been immensely immoral when it comes to Cuba. Is that a fair assessment of who these Miami Cubans are?
I think the older generation of Miami Cubans are people who long expected to return to the country and take back the control of the economy and the houses they had left and all of that. And I think that's been the driving force for the hardline sectors of the community. Yeah, the founder of the Cuban American National Foundation, the kind of leading group in the organized group in the exile community, pretty clearly saw himself as returning in triumph to Havana as Cuba's next president.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I think that was the vision of that sector. I mean, because that community is changing in general, it's people are retiring and dying, younger people are coming
right.
in, and so on. That's beginning to change. But I think that's probably a fair characterization of the first generation, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what about the second generation? Because there must be many of the older people who are no longer around.
Right. This is the interesting thing. There's, I think there's probably three different groups in this younger generation. One, and probably the largest single group, is people who have their parents' point of view but don't feel it that strongly.
Mm.
We did a focus group in Miami 5 or 6 years ago. It was fascinating because for a lot of younger people, younger Cuban Americans, they hate Fidel Castro, they hate the Cuban government, and so on. But the level of intensity is just really, really different than that of their parents, and it ranks on, you know, number 8 or number 10 on their set of issues, not number 1 the way it does for their parents. So that's one, and they don't think about it a lot. I mean, that's kind of the view they express, but it's just not that important to them. There's a second group, and it's smaller, but it's growing, of people who've actually rethought the policy. And we've worked closely with kind of a growing group of moderate Cuban Americans who, including, for example, some Bay of Pigs veterans, who have thought about it and concluded that the approach we have doesn't work, and who think what we ought to do is engage with Cuba again. And they're a really interesting set of people, and a couple of them are actually people in this photo exhibit. And then the third group is really newer immigrants who, you know, came here primarily for economic rather than political reasons, and who think the embargo ought to end because they don't hate their own government, frankly. They may want to change it, they may not be in love with it, but replacing it is not what they're primarily about. So that third group is the least likely to be citizens at this point and the least likely to be registered to vote. But over time, that's already begun to change, and it's going to change more. And over time, that community is really going to be mm-hmm. have a different point of view than it has in the last 40 years.
Isn't it remarkable, Jeff, how long this has gone on?
It's just astonishing. I mean, like I say, I don't think that the argument made sense in the Cold War, personally. But it's certainly, we're talking 50 years now. I mean, the Cuban Revolution is 50 years old next year. January 1st, it's 50 years old.
Oh my gosh.
And we've had an embargo against Cuba for 49 of those 50 years. And it's, I think this is doing the same thing over and over again when it doesn't work is sometimes cited as a definition of clinical insanity. It's a definition you might apply to this policy.
Sherry from Duluth. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I went down to Cuba about 10 years ago. There was a delegation from Duluth that was looking into a sister city connection.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's great.
And I have to tell you, the thing that stuck in my mind more than anything was we were able to visit schools and factories and farms and doctors and hospitals. And, of course, the education is provided. But one of the doctors had told me, because I was so impressed with their pay equity system,
mm-hmm.
he said, we're educated by our government, and those of us that are lucky enough to be doctors and lawyers and professionals feel that, you know, we enjoy our jobs. We're able to go out every day and you know, take a lot of pride and pleasure in our work. And we think it's totally fair that the people that clean the toilets and do all the dirty work, they can't get that pleasure from their job, but they should be paid well because they don't have this benefit we do. And I just found that so inspiring here. And one of my concerns is, I'd like to see our government have more of some of Cuba's feelings about some of these things, and I hope they don't have to change some of their real good policies and so forth as we start to become more interactive with them. Anyway, that always stuck in my mind. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for calling. I think that is one of the really striking things is that, as I said, the best paid people in Cuba might make twice what the worst paid people make, but that gap compared to the gap you see in the United States or anywhere else in the world is really small. And so there's a sense in which people feel much more each other's peers and equals in Cuba than they do in many other countries, and that really is a striking kind of thing. And, you know, as a sign of social equality, a really great thing. I mean, probably the single most dramatic example of that is before 1959, the Afro-Cuban community is the poorest sector of Cuban society. And while there's still there's sort of debate among specialists about the extent of the progress Afro-Cubans have made, everybody agrees they've made it. And for years, the strongest supporters of the Cuban Revolution have been Afro-Cuban populations. I visited Havana one time, and actually I visited Santiago de Cuba on the other end of the island one time. And I met this guy who lived in this very nice house, an Afro-Cuban guy. He's a teacher. And he pointed to the house and he said, my father was the servant at that house, and today I'm the owner of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a really striking kind of difference and an example of the progress some sectors have really made there.
Yeah. Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I was listening to BBC last night, and that thing you're just talking about, that salary equality thing, is going to be rescinded, changed. It's going from, you know, this is seen as the one move that Raoul has made that really slaps the face of Marxism, that there will be greater pay inequity. You will be paid for what you do, what you're able to do, more or less for what you produce, than simply drawing a salary every week, every month, for doing whatever job you are doing. And this move towards capitalism is seen as a very good thing, and one of those things that Raoul is doing to bring Cuba, you know, into more in line with world economies. But what I was mentioning is that the BBC had a woman on, and I hope I get her name right, Ninoska Perez Castellón.
Oh, uh-huh.
and she sounded like she was Batista's granddaughter. She was real hardcore, and I hadn't heard anyone like her in a long time. So I was very interested in what you said about, you know, what is the strength of these people right now, and when what was the group that Obama talked to a couple weeks ago in Miami? Was it this group?
It wasn't Enoshka Perez. It was the Cuban American National Foundation.
Okay. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up, is that what the last caller found was so wonderful about Cuba with a pay equity across the board is going away and it's becoming more market oriented.
Hmm. Yeah, a couple of things about that. One, I think it's pretty clear that Raul Castro's a real pragmatist on the economy, and I don't think he is embracing sort of, you know, Ronald Reagan style free market reforms. But Cuba is clearly experimenting with changes, trying to figure out what's going to work to stimulate their economy. So one of the things they did just announce, as the caller says, as Paul says, is that they have freed up salary schedules. And, you know, one of the results of that is there will be, there will be increased pay inequality. At the same time, where they're starting from is kind of much, and where they're going to end up are both probably different places than you see in a lot of other countries in Latin America. So I think inequality is probably likely to increase and economic incentives to increase. I don't think, well, we'll see, but I don't think they're going to kind of reach the extent or go to the extent they've gone in other countries. And on the other question, Ninoshka Perez, there continues to be a really hardline sector in the Miami Cuban community. There's no question about that. It's very politically active and everything else. Ninoshka Perez is a radio commentator, and she's one of the most outspoken advocates of that point of view. She's one of the leading spokespeople against letting Cuban Americans visit their relatives.
Hmm. And must have a lot of influence, huh?
They do. I mean, there are three Cuban American members of Congress, and they're all Republican. There are four. Three of them, the three from Miami, are all Republicans, and they're hardline defenders of the current policy.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, two of them are brothers, and they are related by they are nephews, I believe, of the last vice president of Cuba before Fidel Castro, and they are relatives of Fidel Castro's first wife. So there's a whole sort of personal side to that.
Right,
there.
Right. Thanks, Paul, for the call. Jeff from Brookfield, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've seen some documentaries in the last year or two that discussed how Cuba had to go through a sort of self-induced oil crisis when the Soviet Union collapsed, and that they have adapted some of their agriculture and their transportation to deal with scarce or expensive fuel.
Yep.
And I guess I'd be curious to get your impressions along those lines and see if perhaps they have like a role to play as far as helping us figure out some of the challenges we'll be facing with what we're dealing with energy and oil.
That's actually an interesting point. After the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, Cuba's economy went into crisis. Production went down more than it did in the Great Depression here in the United States. And one of the results was it was very, very difficult for them to buy and import oil. Public transportation was cut back. Private cars were cut back. People used bicycles. To me, what's actually the most interesting thing is that of necessity, Cuba moved from industrial sort of agriculture that used petrochemicals and fertilizer and a lot of transportation to organic farming. And it's really fascinating. I visited an organic farm once that combined sort of communist cadres and the fabulous furry freak brothers. I mean, it was just a fascinating example of this transition made of necessity, not sort of hippie desires, right, but toward more organic agriculture. And I think there are some interesting lessons there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. We have time for one more phone call. It'll have to be brief. Mike from Whitefish Bay. Hi.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could comment on the expediency of the political expediency of Cuba's friendly relations towards Venezuela and how that might, you know, be shooting themselves in the foot by associating with another enemy of the U.S. foreign policy.
Let me try and do this. It's obviously a big topic, but just very
30
quickly.
30 seconds. Sorry.
Okay. Venezuela, people see Venezuela as kind of the new threat in the hemisphere, and I think that's a real exaggeration. I think Cuba's got a relationship there. I also think it has a relationship with Brazil and a lot of other countries, so that I don't think we should fear some Cuba-Venezuela axis that's a threat to the U.S.
Jeff, thank you so much. People will be looking forward to seeing you tomorrow in Milwaukee.
Thanks, Kathleen. I'm happy to do this.
Jeff Thiel, Program Director of the Washington Office on Latin America. The book is Love, Loss, and Longing, The Impact of U.S. Travel Policy on Cuban-American Families. Jeff will be at the Schwartz Bookstore in Shorewood tomorrow at 7 o'clock to talk about this book, which is a collection of photos and interviews with Cuban-Americans who are no longer able to visit their relatives in Cuba more than once every 3 years due to an administration change in regulations. The interviews include some really heartwarming stories from people who can't legally visit their dying parents or see close relatives because of these regulations. We thank Jeff for being with us, Program Director of the Washington Office on Latin America. We thank also Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your great calls this morning. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We'll return with more Thursday conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.